Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's July 20th, 2012. You're listening to the best PokerCast in the world. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Have you realized that they are calling the final nine the Octonine?
Yeah, you know, and here's the thing. I think if they're going to call it that, they should have given the Octomom a free entry. So she had a chance to make the Octonine. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Well, wasn't she stripping, like, right down the street?
Yeah, absolutely. Wouldn't that be an amazing storyline for this? Octomom makes the Octonine... performs before.
They'll put the stripper pole right on the middle of the poker table. She could dance around and keep everybody entertained. You know, and to me, when I hear Octonine, I think like they should all be dressed up in superhero garb or something.
Maybe Josie Buck and Gavin Smith can take care of that, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, not to get us going on the old dress code thing again, but... You know, you make the Octonine, you have to come dressed as your favorite Marvel or DC comic, you know, villain or superhero.
Well, I'll say that there's very few superhero costumes out there that are less professional than what some of these people wear.
That's true.
It's not going to be a degradation of the dress up.
You'll notice that all of these superheroes wear shoes.
That is true.
Not sandals. So.
Even Aquaman?
I think even Aquaman has, like, boots. Like
boots?
green boots, so...
I don't think he would have flippers. Why wouldn't he have flippers?
All right, we've set a record for starting the show without talking about poker.
No, seriously, I'd go to the Superman, I'm like, hey, dude.
He's got boots, too.
Like, you know, can I get a requisition here, go down to equipment? Be far more effective with flippers. But, of course, we're talking about the World Series of Poker main event.
Yes.
When it resumes October 29th. Always called the November 9 the last couple of years, but starting in October, so they had it. Some clever person out there came up with the Octo 9. And, you know, hey, I can't come up with anything better. Did anything better?
Nah, not really.
I
did say they should go down to 8, and then they can call them the October, you know, the Oto 8 or something, because Oto, October. But yes. But that didn't work out, so.
Oto plus 1.
Yeah, exactly. So that didn't work out. But Octo 9's kind of funny. Octo 9.
Yeah, it's clever. I'll give it to him.
I'll give it to him.
And, after last year's international-flavored November 9, this year's Octo 9, decidedly American, Chris.
Yes, incredible, which I believe I wrote into the story for our magazine that it was pretty much like you had mentioned before, like a microcosm of the entire series itself, where Americans just dominated all year. I mean, whether it was the Euro being weak or just coincidence or variance or whatever, but you're right, Americans, 8 of the 9 were Americans.
Yeah, the only non-American, Hungary's Andras Korakotny.
No.
Not even close, right?
You know, you've really been murdering the English language the last couple of weeks, and now you're treading on Hungary as well, is what I was going to say. I think it's Korakotny, but I don't know.
Oh, that sounds better. That's awesome.
But a lot of interesting stories come through it, and really, 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 really thought this was going to be the first year that we had a woman at the final table since... I guess it would be Barbara Enright since Annie Duke finished 10th. That doesn't really count. So, but it didn't happen. It wasn't meant to be. They finished 10th and 11th.
That's amazing.
That never happened either. Two women in the top 11 like that. But a lot of good stories coming out.
Yeah. The youngest player, 21-year-old Jake Balsinger. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Of Arizona. Can become the youngest world champion ever. Eventually, this is going to be amazing. I mean... somebody's going to have to petition the World Series to quit doing the Octo 9, November 9, because the window of being able to be the youngest champion is going to close to the point where it's not possible anymore.
Oh, right, exactly, because you're delaying it by...
Because you got to be 21, and you got to be at least 21 in a couple months now.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the youngest you can be, just by the chance, by the time it finishes out, right?
Right, exactly. You can win an undercard bracelet on your, you know, on a week after your 21st birthday or something, but not this, so...
Yeah.
That's right, I never thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, how many of the last couple of years has this been possible that there could be the youngest champion?
Yeah.
It seems like it's been... This might be probably, what, the third in recent memory?
It seems like every year since Kata broke it. So that was, what, 09? No.
Yeah.
Was it 09? Yeah. I don't know. So it seems like every year that he's done it, they've had somebody who could break the record. And somebody, you know, close to it. Or even, Eastgate was 08, right? So Eastgate had broken the record. Then Kata had broken that record. So, yeah, even since Eastgate, it seems like someone's always doing it or can do it. So pretty amazing stuff. These young kids, remarkable.
These kids these days. But hey, representing the dinosaurs like us out there is going to be 57-year-old Stephen Gee of California. That one I know I hit out of the park.
It could be Stephen G.
Ooh.
Which I think it probably is Stephen G.
All right, so I probably just bucked it there.
You hit it out of the park, but it was just foul. Now, here's the deal. I don't really relate to someone 57 years old yet. That's a whole... person who can drive a car older than me. So
I tell you, I relate 98% better to a 57-year-old than I do to a 21-year-old.
Yeah, that's probably right. That's probably right. I like to think of myself in the middle there, but...
Yeah, well, yeah. Besides Gee/G, only one other player at the table is older than 32, and that's not shocking, because it's been the youth movement for the last couple years there.
And then, you know, we of course were following very carefully our good friend Annie Up National, Annie Up Strategy columnist, man who makes me pull my hair out, Lee Childs, who finished 382nd for a while there. What, he was in the top 50, right?
Yeah, he was going into day 4, I think. He was 56th in chips, and then ended up going out 382nd. Nice little payday there. I know, obviously, it's the one tournament where you can make a lot of money and still be really disappointed.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he is. But he had a good series out there. He had, you know, that good run at the Venetian event, and then, you know, a couple other real good deep World Series runs. And this is 2 years in a row that he's cashing the main event.
Yeah, he really rallied at the end. When we were out there, was it late June? Or, you know, he was a little frustrated with some of the way things were going because he wasn't playing bad, just getting bad results. And then, you know, he stuck with it, and that's what a good pro does. And then, like, as soon as we left, it's like, boom, boom, boom. He's making final tables. He's going deep. He's cashing. So he had quite a few caches this year in the World Series. And like you said, the Venetian had that nice final table where he finished, was it fourth, I guess? So, you know, kudos to him. And I hope he's not too upset over this and is doing okay now.
Another great stat about Lee. He's entered the main event 6 times. Cash 3 times.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
50% cash rate in the biggest tournament
that's
in the world.
Pretty damn good.
Not a lot of people can say that, I don't think so. But, you know, once Lee bowed out, we still had a rooting interest at the World Series. Poker Geek MN's brother, Cameron Somsky, was still alive and kept his run going until he finished 301st. And actually, we appreciate it. He even slapped a little Annie Up magazine patch on when he was at the feature table one day.
Yeah, that was awesome. And I didn't even know Geek had a brother, much less a brother who played poker.
Oh, you didn't know that?
And plays poker better than Geek.
No, he plays really well. He's made some final tables. I remember Geek telling me at some of the events up in the Midwest. He's actually from Missouri.
Oh.
So he's not Minnesota native, or I don't know if he's a native, but doesn't live in Minnesota with Geek. But yeah, he travels and plays a lot of good events, and... That's a great finish there. 301st. That's about 6,300 spots better than I finished this year.
you know, before we move on from it, I have to say that I was very disappointed that there was no live coverage other than the big drop, you know, big one, whatever. I missed the live coverage. I mean, I didn't really look into why. We're a little too busy here right now to be looking at stuff like that and wondering, but. I'm wondering it now. I mean, why did they not do it? Was it just too many man hours? Why would they just do it 1 year when everyone loved it? They didn't keep doing it, and that was really disappointing. I know they did it for the charity event, and they're going to do it for the final table here in October, but I missed it. I mean, I liked it, and I missed it. Now, I admit that when I did watch the live coverage, I wasn't enthused about watching the post-production right. coverage. Maybe that's why they stopped doing
it. Could be. I mean, we talked about that last year, didn't we?
Yeah.
That as exciting as it was when you got around to the TV part, which, you know, ESPN's paying some good rights for, I assume. People will have seen it all already.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're right. I don't know what it was. There could be lots of reasons. I mean, it is expensive to do, so that's probably the most probable reason. But it wouldn't shock me if, you know, they wanted to keep the TV fresh.
I loved it, and I really thought that they were going to keep doing it and then maybe get rid of the post-production stuff or kind of hammer all that out during the live, you know, final table or something, or, you know, the next week or something. But I don't know. I just missed it. I really missed it. I liked seeing the live stuff and knowing I could tune in every night and watch it rather than follow it on Twitter or whatever. Maybe it was because they wanted to do more of the, you know, they had done all those live streams during leading up to it and stuff. Maybe that, I don't know. But I missed it terribly on normal TV.
Well, you know, another thing we missed terribly is online poker.
That's true.
And, you know, I think folks that listen to the show know that they've learned that you and I don't get excited about anything really anymore because everybody tries to get your hopes up and it never really works out. So taking this latest news with a grain of salt. In fact, actually, I even dismissed it when I first saw the first story, but there's been some follow-up reporting that's kind of making it sound like it might have legs, very small legs, I think. But the website Gambling Compliance this week broke a story that claimed that U.S. Senators Harry Reid and John Kyle had reached an agreement on online poker legislation to be introduced during Congress's lame duck session, which happens after the November's election. And, I mean, like I said, I'm like, okay, yeah, sure, great. But, you know, these are the two guys that we've been rumored for a while that really kind of control the Senate. And John Kyle has actually been a huge opponent of online gaming forever. And, you know, depending on the reports you believe, it was the guy that really killed the last effort.
Yeah.
But they've kind of sold him on the online poker being different than gaming, which is great. It's very hard to get a lawmaker that's actually able to think like that.
Yeah.
So it sounds like they made some progress, possibly. And then since then, it does sound like a deal might have been reached. Reid told the National Journal that he and Kyle had worked, quote, very hard. That's good. That's what we pay you to do. but he said, honestly, Republican support in the Senate just isn't there yet. So they're going to continue to work on it. But sounds like they've had a breakthrough, so now the next step is to actually, you know, the Senate. And from, you know, past stories and comments from, you know, Joe Barton and other places, it seems like it's going to be a lot easier to get through the House. So if they can break through the Senate, who knows, we might have a Christmas miracle.
I often wonder if there are other podcasts out there that are for, like, you know, I don't know, blackjack and roulette, and they're all sitting there going, damn, why can't they do a carve out for casino games, you know, and all that, you know, because we're the ones that have the one game that's in a casino that is skill based that we can get online, maybe because we can get people to soften up and realize it's a skill game. But these other ones, they don't have a shot at online gaming, you know what I mean? I just wonder if they're reacting, how they're reacting, right, and if those things exist.
Yeah, and you mentioned blackjack. I mean, with the real frustrating thing about that, if you're a blackjack player, is a blackjack tournament is a skill-based variation of a game that's not particularly skill-based. So, you know, and Ultimate Bet used to have that blackjack site for a while.
Yep, I remember that.
You could play tournaments. I would love to see something like that come back. But you're right, at that point, I mean, it's already hard enough to try to get poker, get people to understand that poker is different than these other games, and then you go back to the same lawmaker and say, well, you know, I told you that this is different than blackjack, but this is a tournament blackjack, and that's completely different. You know, good luck with that. So, yeah, I think it's probably a double pill to swallow for those folks.
So let me ask you this. Let's say they do get an agreement during the lame duck session somehow, and then we have federal, somehow, regulation of online poker at some point in the next year or whatever, two or whatever.
Right.
All these states that are passing their own thing, they can still do their own thing, right? They don't have to abide by the federal regulations, do they?
Yeah, you know, that's going to be interesting. I mean, I think it's all going to depend on what the legislation's like. I mean, what we've been hearing is all the legislation on the federal level is going to be allowed is going to allow states to opt out of it, right. You know, so they don't have to participate. I don't necessarily know whether there's going to be some consideration for states that want to do it themselves. But here's kind of the – this is what I think is going to be very fascinating about this is there are going to be states, and particularly I would say Nevada, that are very progressive on this and say, you know, hey, we're not going to get the player liquidity here, but we're the national leader in getting things going and regulated here, so we absolutely want the federal level. Want our players to be playing on the federal. And then you're going to have some other states that aren't going to really understand that whole player liquidity argument and are probably going to opt out and try to do their own thing out of greed and find out it doesn't work out.
Yeah, and fail.
And that's what's going to be really frustrating is if players live in one of those states that right now they're excited, hey, we're going to be on the forefront of online poker, or at least I'll be able to play in my own state for a while until the feds get it right. And then it may end up being... what's the reverse of a blessing in disguise?
a devil in something.
A Kardashian in disguise. So yeah, I don't know. It's going to be interesting, but I aside from just stubborn knucklehead lawmakers, I can't see why any states would really want to do it themselves. When they actually are being getting good, honest advice from folks on the player liquidity question. So, But you know, that's been the push in a lot of the legislatures is, hey, let's get in there and get our stuff approved before the federal government comes in and tells us how to do it. So, I mean, it's not an unrealistic fear to have that there still could be a patchwork out there of different places.
Yeah.
At this point, I'm going to say I'm happy I live in Florida where nothing's going on right now. I'll change my tune in January if this whole thing doesn't work out. But
And I would think that the states would recognize they would want as many people as possible visiting their own sites or getting that piece of the national pie when, say, a PokerStars comes back because they got their deal through and were, you know, forgiven for all their whatever it was. And then... all of a sudden, you got PokerStars offering their poker to everybody, and they've got their worldwide people coming in and playing. Obviously, that piece of that pie would be much larger than, say, in Iowa trying to get enough liquidity out of their own state. So, I mean, I think a lot of them would recognize that it's better to have all that federal money coming in than just your own state.
Here's the flaw in your logic.
Okay.
You're a rational person.
Oh, yeah.
I don't often say that about you, by the way. But on this issue, you are completely rational, and you're assuming that everybody else out there is completely rational as well.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, here's the thing. I mean, this is it's a different kind of business, and I tell people this a lot when I travel. You know, if you owned a coffee shop, let's say, all right, and you had the option of opening in a town and being the only coffee shop in town, or opening in the town across the county... where you were competing with a lot of other coffee shops, which one would you choose?
Right. I choose the fax machine. Somebody's faxing in an order right now.
Excellent. I think, see, what it is somebody is like, hey, I know where you're going with this, Scott. I got to call you right now.
Grand latte to go.
And tell you what's going on. But, you know, there's awfully a lot of people out there that would say, give me the monopoly. Why would I want to compete with anyone? Give me that monopoly. Every person that wants a cup of coffee is going to come into my shop and drink coffee.
Yeah.
And I think that's what some of these states would think. Now, the difference between a coffee shop and an online poker site is you only need one customer to come in the morning to buy coffee, to sell them coffee. If one poker player comes in your poker room in the morning, you're going to have a dealer staring at one person.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the thing. So it's tough. That's a tough thing to convince people that don't understand it, that you're going to have, by sharing, you're going to get a lot more money because there's going to be some more people involved, whereas if you go it alone, you get to keep 100% of it, but you're not going to get... you're going to get 100% of much less.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see if they... Well, first let's just see if this happens, and then we'll see how everything else goes. But it's good news that they're talking publicly about it. You know, usually they don't talk about stuff publicly like this until they're really close to doing something significant. You know, I mean, usually this stuff is is under wraps for a long time. So when they're finally actually talking on the record to publications like the Las Vegas Journal or whatever, then you know things are happening. So we'll see. We'll hopefully have something for the nation pretty soon.
Really hope so. Really hope so.
All right, our hotline is 813-448-1120. You call it, we use it, we'll give you something pretty cool. This one comes from Scott in Michigan.
Just wanted to call Buster Chops a little bit. A few years ago, I listening to some of your early podcasts, and I had called in and basically busted Chris's chops for using the term re-rays inappropriately. At the time, I basically said that I was anal, and inappropriate poker terms bothered me, and I called him out basically, and he was using the term re-raise when he meant raise of a bet, and you guys, you know, put it on the air, may have had a little fun with it, but anyway, I'm getting back into the podcast again. I was away for a while. I've been re-listening to some recent podcasts, and I was listening to Scott tell the tale of a recent tournament that he was in, and I believe it was the one that he chopped. You had indicated that during the tournament you had gone in several times, and you won those pots and doubled through your opponents. And I believe you might have been using that term incorrectly, because you only double through an opponent when that opponent has more chips than you, but less than twice as many chips as you, thereby basically flip-flopping in your position in chips. If the person has more than double the chips, you're not doubling through them, you're doubling up, but they have more chips than you, and you have not increased your position in the order of chip stack.
All right, I was going to answer this, but at the beginning of the show, you said you were going to take it, so I'm just going to stand out of the way and see what you have to say.
Well, first of all, you know, I love that he reflected on busting my chops with the old re-raise thing, and then not only that, but a few moments later, he says he was re-listening to recent PokerCasts, and I thought, you were gone for a long time, then you came back, and then re-listened to new shows? No, I think you just listened to some new shows. So, how you liking that, Scott? I'm busting your chops a little bit there. No, really, when he talks about doubling up or doubling through, I have to admit that I've always thought they were the same thing, so I looked it up, and every single instance that I looked up double through's definition, they said it's when you double up. And every single instance that I saw where it said you double up, you double through. I've seen them, every definition that it's interchangeable, and I've never seen one definition saying that they're different from each other.
Wow.
So I just want to know that.
Say, hey, Scott, I apologize. Good point.
Yeah, because you know what, too? I knew you were going to apologize, and I said, no, wait a minute. Let me at least look it up before you sit there and mea culpa for no reason. So I looked it up, and really, it's interchangeable with a billion different glossary websites and definitions. I mean, when the word double is double, whether it's up because you've doubled up your stack or through someone, if somebody has more chips than me and my stack is now double that size, I've doubled through that person. Now, it doesn't mean that you've exchanged positions or whatever it was, the definition. I've never heard of anybody making a distinction. I mean, it's kind of like the whole set trips thing where,
right,
no, it's two in your hand, and all right, yeah, we know, but three of a kind is three of a kind. You have three of a kind regardless of how you want to do it. Yeah, it's better for storytelling so people know what you're talking about,
right? Yeah,
but you still have trips when you have two in your hand and one on a thing, or you have one on, you know, two on a thing and one in your hand. I mean, so I don't know, I've never heard of anyone make the distinction between up and through. I'm going on a limb here.
It's got stuff, and he sold it well to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying he's wrong.
It could
either make
sense. I mean, maybe it is one of those, like you said, the trip sets, that it's a subtle distinction that might help. I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, somebody said, hey, I doubled through or doubled up, I wouldn't really think about it differently.
Yeah.
Until now. Now, yeah. I certainly will going forward.
Yeah, I've never heard of it having a distinction. And so, like I said, I was pretty diligent, and given the time I had this morning between doing the magazine and everything else for the show, I looked at a bunch of, I kept looking and looking and looking. I even typed in, like, double up versus double through and difference and distinction and all that and whatever I could. And every definition for either one, especially when it said double through, if you looked up double through, it basically said double up your chips, double your chips. When someone has more chips than you and you go all in, they call and you win, you've doubled up or doubled through. I mean, I've never heard of it different any other way. So, you know, if we're probably going to get his anger on another call, but really, give me a reference. I want to know where you think why you think that's what it is, and if you've seen it officially somewhere. Fair. You know what I mean?
That helps us learn.
Yeah, right. I would feel much better if I knew, like, it was an official book of terms written by Doyle Brunson or something, you know, but to just say it and then have us think it's fact, we really have to do our diligence on it, and I think it's the same thing.
Hmm. All right, Scott, well, don't worry, even though we're beating you up here, we're going to be happy to send you a t-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Annie Up store at annieupstore.com. Go there and you can buy a second shirt and double through PMS Pokerware.
Oh,
or double up if that's your cup of tea. But everybody else, remember to call the hotline at 813-448-1120. And you too might get made fun of us by us, but we'll happy to give you a prize like that.
Oh, man. Okay, our mailbag comes from Ed McDonald. And he's one of our Apes legends, isn't he? Isn't that what I'm thinking?
Legend is probably too small of a word.
Yeah, he was incredible in Apes, especially that one year. That one year he just cranked.
When we bring Apes back, it's not going to be Get Bananas a trophy. It's going to be McDonald's sculptured banana. A banana in his likeness.
McDonald's Happy Meals.
You know, maybe his head popping out of the top of it, you know? Kind of like he's like in a banana sleeping bag. That would be awesome.
Oh, my God. All right, well, he wants to know, why does my local poker room not have tournaments in the evening on the weekends? They have one on Saturday that starts at 10 a.m., but it's capped at 50 players. A lot of my friends and I have talked about how we would like to drive up and play in it, but we fear driving the 1.5 hours to get there to hear the tournament is full.
Yeah, this is a... I do a lot of education when I'm on the road.
Yeah.
The first thing I think folks need to understand is that tournaments don't pay the bills in poker room. It's very hard for poker rooms to make money on tournaments, even these larger ones. I mean, obviously the World Series of Poker probably made a crap ton of money for Caesars Entertainment, but for the most part, tournaments, they don't get enough rake out of them to pay it. Their dealers don't get enough, even if they do the add-ons and everything. So poker rooms offer tournaments for two different reasons, I think. One, just as a customer service, because people ask for it and they want to keep their customers happy. But two, usually to get people into the room, play a tournament, and hope, pray, that they stick around and play cash games where they actually make their money off them. So I don't think it's very rare for a lot of poker rooms, particularly smaller ones, to do exactly this. Have a tournament during a slow time of the day, get you in there, and then hope you stick around. So it's not so much, I mean, if they did a tournament at night, when they have a bunch of cash games going, they don't need to get you in at that point. And even worse, they don't want to close down cash games in order to offer that. And now, obviously, you know, some rooms might run tournaments twice a day and stuff. It just depends on capacity, I think. But I think you got to think of it from the poker room standpoint.
I got two things to say about it. One, a good example of what you were talking about is the Charlestown casino. When they first opened, they just did not have tournaments, and we would call like every other month or whatever and say, hey, do you guys have tournaments yet? We want to list them. And they're like, nope, still cranking with 30 cash games a day, and and that was what it was. They had no reason to run tournaments or series. Now the interest has waned. People have, you know, decided that they want to play there, or they don't want to play there, or their other casinos have opened, or whatever it is, and now they're starting to finally, or people are clamoring for them, whatever it is. They're finally, months later, offering a tournament schedule. And it's because they were just cranking with cash games. They make so much money on cash games, and people are showing up, there's no reason to attract them. Now, the thing I wanted to say about his situation, Ed's, have you tried calling the poker room manager, or talking to the poker room manager and saying, hey, can you hold three spots for me? Can I call ahead? Can I pay ahead?
Yeah.
You know, whatever. I realize it's an hour and a half drive, so you don't want to go all the way down there, pay for it, then drive an hour and a half home, and then drive back an hour and a half the next day, right, or whatever it is that you have to play it. But, you know, I think I remember Derby Lane would hold a spot for me when I was playing pretty regularly on that Saturday tournament, because you get down there on a Saturday, and the line was like 300 people long, and they only had a place for 110 or whatever it was way back when. So I'm pretty sure that a lot of people will hold a spot for it, especially when it's capped like that and it's only 50 players. If not, then, you know, then yeah, you're just going to have to deal with it somehow. But, you know, I know that a lot of places will do that for you, especially if you're a treasured, you know, a regular or something like that, where they want your business and they know that you're going to show up and talk good about the place and whatever. So maybe give that a shot.
Yeah, can't hurt, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, just a kind of a general understanding of just the poker economics might help a little bit. If you're a tournament only player, I'm not saying poker rooms don't want your business, but they're going to prefer a cash game only player's business to you.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. You shouldn't feel like a second class citizen. Just understand that you're not as valuable to them as somebody else is. So.
Right, right. It doesn't fit into their business model at that time or whatever, which is like the Charleston situation. And eventually they'll come around. The 50 cap kind of stinks. It's probably because of the small room and they can't
afford to go in.
So you got what you got to do.
All right, Ed, well, we appreciate that. Guess what? You don't have to drive even 0.5 hours to get some swag today. We're going to send it right to your doorstep. A deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Annie Up. Pick up your own decks in the Annie Up store at annieupstore.com and email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com, and you too might win something great.
I think it's your turn to read a call on the floor here.
I can do it. I'm up for it. All right, this comes from longtime listener Gary Rawson, and he says, I'm playing in a $50 tournament at a casino in Pennsylvania, and we're at the final table. Although I just left the table there. We're at the table. That's a good place to be when you're in a tournament, right?
Yeah.
but no, he's at the final table. tournament pays out 6 spots.
Okay, 6 spots.
The chip leader has been asking the table to take up a collection for the bubble since we were 9-handed. And when we're down to 7 players, everyone but me agrees to it. The chip leader asks everyone to chip in except for me, and I won't get anything if I bubble. Everyone starts throwing the chip leader money, and the clock is still running, but we're not playing because of this. I look at the dealer and the floor person watching, but they don't say anything. I thought about bringing it up, but I thought that would just make the clock run longer, and I'm short-stacked. Should I have said something, and would the floor have done anything if I had?
All right, Gary, here's what Jody had to say. Most tournament directors will stop the clock one time during a tournament while the players discuss a deal. I understand you're wanting the clock to not run while they collected the bubble money. I think you made a wise choice by not saying anything instead of having the clock continue to run while they addressed your concern. I would have simply asked out loud, can you stop the clock? And if the response was no, then I would have politely asked the dealer to deal the next hand. This may or may not work, but it's worth a shot. I would definitely ask about it the next time I played there.
My opinion, I guess, is this is probably a room where they're used to taking up a bubble collection.
Right.
The room I play in most, that's kind of standard. People just expect it. And you certainly have a right to not participate in that if you don't want to.
Right.
It's your money.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that, but I think it's kind of standard, and I think at this point, Gary, who was exercising his absolute right not to be part of it, kind of was a fly in the ointment in an otherwise fairly efficient process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, generally when I'm in these bubble saves, it happens really quickly, and it doesn't really cause some consternation. Here it sounds like maybe it did a little bit. Obviously if everybody else is getting bubble saved, they don't care that the clock is running necessarily. But you have a person here who's not part of it, so obviously he's affected by it. But I definitely agree. Well, I mean, I don't see any problem in saying something. I mean, as Jody said, you know, hey, if you guys are doing a deal, stop the clock. That's generally how it works in most rooms.
Yeah.
When they do a deal. Usually most rooms, they'll only do it once, though. They're not going to stop the clock 100 times while they keep negotiating. But that's not an outrageous question to ask. And as Jerry said, if they say, no, we're going to keep running, then you're a paying customer. I would tell that dealer, please deal with the cards. Either deal the cards or stop the clock.
What I think is fascinating is that he was the short stack and didn't want the deal. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, good for him that he thinks that he's going to cash anyway or wants to earn that, you know, that sixth place money or whatever it is that he... And I wonder how he finished, actually, in this event, because I don't think he said, but... That's pretty fascinating that he's the short stack and he doesn't want to get paid if he goes out next. That's integrity, I guess.
Yeah, as usual, I edit these letters heavily down. I believe he actually went out on the bubble and didn't get anything.
Oh, man.
But, and he had a reason for not wanting to make the deal, and I wish I could call it up.
Even so, I mean, that's just, that's still something to be said there. There's got to be, something where he just wants to earn the most money or he wants to, you know, whatever. But but there's definitely nothing wrong with saying, hey, you know, you're doing a deal. Stop the clock for us. And if they say no, then you say, okay, then deal, you know, because we got to play. I'm short stacked here. No reason why you can't say your concerns. I would. I would definitely.
And they're valid concerns. I mean, you're not demanding anything. You're just giving a simple choice. You know, right. You either please stop the clock or let's deal and continue playing. There's not a rational person in the world that would have a problem with that. I can't imagine.
No, me neither.
Now, obviously, we've already... you know, again, I edited this down, and apparently this chip leader guy was very insistent on taking a bubble collection from the very beginning and got kind of angry at Gary for consistently saying no, which, you know, one of Gary's other questions is why is this guy so adamant on him? He's the chip leader.
Yeah.
Which is a very good other question that we could answer later on. But I think Gary was worried that he's already kind of been, you know, poking the bear a little bit for all the players at the table, and then to have to continue poking at this point probably wasn't something he felt comfortable with. But he should have.
I can only imagine what it was like when he did get knocked out, what they were saying and doing. You know, if they were unhappy with him, and then he gets knocked out, and they're going to be like, you know, that's justice or something. Who knows? Hey, remember a couple weeks back when we talked about one of our listeners had asked us what we thought, you know, life would be like if Moneymaker hadn't won, if Farhat called that bluff and then went on to win the whole thing?
Yeah, I thought it was a great question, so great that I actually even threw him some extra swag, because I thought we were going to have a great show with all this great feedback from our listeners on it, because I thought it really was a fascinating question. It took us 2 weeks to even get one response, but we got one good response from Rich Santoro, and we're very appreciative of that. But yeah, I really thought we were going to have a whole show about this, but...
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, like I said, I almost knocked Sammy Farhat over, so just a little while ago. So if he had won, I would have intentionally knocked him over, so I could say, "Hey, I knocked over a world champion." So that's how the story changes for me if he had called the bluff. But here's what Rich had to say. He said, "What really generated the poker boom? It was the 2003 World Series of Poker ESPN broadcast." I argue that the investment in the 2003 World Series of Poker coverage was the real catalyst behind what was to come over the following decade. Consider that the World Series of Poker was on TV in previous years, but not like it was in 2003. The previous broadcast didn't have the production quality, the primetime TV slot, the editing, the storytelling, the commentary, or hold cards the way the 2003 coverage did. Prior to that year, there was were less quality broadcasts, plenty of online sites in existence, an amateur champion who scored a seven-figure payday, and even celebrity commentators like Dick Van Patten. However, none of that created the success that followed the 2003 broadcast. ESPN found the right formula that year and made it work. After that, Poker Stars did as well. Also considering the question of what if Sammy Farr had called that bluff, I can say as a matter of personal appeal, I was more interested in watching Sammy anyway. His style and image as a sly poker pro just reeked of cool. The smile, the jacket, the slick hair, the cigarette, and the rounder image was almost like watching a character from a movie. He was more intriguing to me than the amateur. Perhaps if he had won, the current dress standards in the game would be better.
Wow. There's a lot to talk about there.
Yeah, great stuff.
I mean, I particularly like the last stuff about Sammy Farah, because, you know, we had this continual discussion going on in the forum about, you know, what we talked about in the show last week about Mike Sexton and players dressing better. And, you know, here's an example of, you know, bringing cool back. And he's right. You know, Sammy, I mean, he's not, I'm sure there's people out there that don't like Sammy, but I think it's hard to argue with what Rich is saying here, that, you know, he's a character. He kind of looks the part. He's got a, if it's cool to say cool anymore, a cool look.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and one of the things that I will agree with, but sort of disagree with in a roundabout way. The ESPN coverage was much better, but I still think it was the hole cards, because they didn't have hole cards in 2002. In 2003 was when the WPT introduced the hole cam, and that's the WPT worked its way into the World Series hole cam. And that's how they... So, I mean, seeing the cards, I think, as part of that coverage. So I agree, it's a lot of that coverage, but seeing the cards was the catalyst within the catalyst, I think, that made it what it was. And I don't really necessarily think it was Moneymaker either. I mean, I think it was him because, you know, the fact that his name was Moneymaker and that he was an amateur, and all of these things came into alignment. But I don't think it was one thing. I don't think it was ESPN. I don't think it was the whole cards. I don't think it was Moneymaker. I don't think it was the internet. I think it was all those things. It was really just planets aligning to have this one great thing happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, but again, you know, I agree with both of you, but you know, the point is, what if Sammy had won? All right. All the TV coverage that Rich is talking about, none of that would have changed. That happened regardless.
Yeah, right.
So I guess the point is, at that point, you know, if Sammy won with this ancillary stuff that happened because this little accountant that won a satellite for $40 with a great name won $3 million, does that trump whatever would have happened if this slick, cool, rounder-looking guy had won?
Right. Yeah, I think that...
That's the question that Gene posed, so...
I think that, you know, when he talks about the fact that he was so cool and all these things that he did was captivating, I think it probably still would have happened. You know, I mean, obviously we've sort of voiced our opinions on this when we introduced the subject before, but I think it still would have happened because of those hole cards, because of the success of the World Poker Tour, because the field had doubled in size, even close to double the size when Moneymaker won, because it was only like, you know, when Robert Varconi won, it was still far less than when Moneymaker won. So the fields were doubling in size as a norm anyway. So I think it would have. I think it still would have taken off if Farr had won.
And the last thing I would say, I think this is interesting too, is that, you know, we all attach ourselves to people on these broadcasts that we like, you know. So for him, you know, I can see this whole thing, hey, Sammy is the kind of a poker player that I had visioned, that's who I want to watch. I think there's a good case to be made that people don't really enjoy watching amateurs play poker. Mm. They enjoy the fact that it's possible that they, as an amateur, could be on TV sometime doing it, but I don't think people want to sit around and watch a bunch of people they don't know necessarily. I mean, that's why people talk about, hey, did you see that big crazy call Tom Dwan made last night? You know, it's not, did you see that crazy good call that Scott Long made?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But it is who you identify with, and I think I've said this on the show before too, but you know, where poker really piqued an interest for me was when Hellmuth won, because, you know, even though the TV coverage wasn't great back then, that was just like me. You know, he was a preppy and a little button-up shirt, and he looked exactly like me, and that's when I'm like, hey, I like this guy, he looks just like me, I didn't expect to see that kind of guy playing poker. So it was actually the opposite effect for me. Now, obviously, we have nothing in common anymore, but at that time...
If Blair Rodman wins the World Series now, we'll have
exactly,
something
to say. Exactly, yes. But it does. I mean, this is one of these things that it's a good discussion to have, but it's also a tough discussion to have because, you know, it's really personal. I mean, who do you identify with more as a viewer, Sammy Farhar or Chris Moneymaker?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the same kind of thing where they're trying to compare ages in baseball, where, you know, would Babe Ruth have been as good as he is now, you know, and all that stuff at the live ball and all that. It's something that you just will never know, but it's fun to talk about. And I really do think that poker still would have taken off, because you could see that there was a momentum there. They launched the World Poker Tour. They didn't launch the World Poker Tour because of Moneymaker. And the whole cam wasn't invented because of Moneymaker, and ESPN didn't do that type of coverage because of Moneymaker. So, I think if Farha won, I think it still, and maybe wouldn't be as big as it is now, but I think it would have. I think it would have ultimately, you know, America was just clamoring for something different, and they're clamoring for something to do with their money and their time and their viewing habits. So I think it would have happened.
You know, the other thing, too, you got to think about is if Sammy won the next year, assuming things didn't change, Greg Raymer's your next champion.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily an amateur, but in the same sense that Moneymaker was, but certainly not a professional, Sammy. So, I mean, you might have had a very similar effect the next year. Probably not as big, but probably big enough to compensate for it. I mean, maybe push back the development a year, but you know, it's entirely defensible to say that at this point in our poker, the history of poker, it wouldn't be that much different had Sammy won.
Well, that was a great topic. You know, I'm saddened that we didn't get enough people coming up with their own scenarios and stuff, but it was still something worth talking about, worth discussing, and thanks to Rich for sending that in.
All right, we'll run through a little housekeeping here. Remember, you only have about 12 days here to take our annual fan survey, the Antis. Go to annieupmagazine.com/survey. Have your voice heard to be entered for thousands of dollars of great prizes, including the grand prize of lunch and a one-hour lesson from Chris Moneymaker, who did win the World Series.
Otherwise, you could have been having lunch with Sammy Farha.
Yeah.
Who wants to eat cigarettes for lunch anyway?
He wasn't smoking. He just had
no, he won't eat them, though. You know,
it was a prop, like a Hollywood star. That's the essence of cool there.
Okay, now pay attention to this next one. Looking for new ambassadors in Central California, Deadwood, Louisiana, and now a new spot has opened up in the Seattle area. We would like for someone in the Seattle area to cover the great Pacific Northwest, Oregon, and you know, any other rooms in Washington. So if you would like to be a part of the magazine and get your ugly mug in the magazine too, apply at annieupmagazine.com/ambassadors, and we will take it under consideration.
And then, of course, it's impossible for you to forget our cruise schedule, but we're going to remind you yet again, two more great cruises, August 27th out of Port Canaveral. We got giveaways still going on at Palm Beach Kennel Club, Seminole, Hard Rock, Hollywood, Tampa Bay Downs, Ebro Graham Park, and there's still Blue Shark Optics is still accepting videos for their giveaway as well, too. And then the November 10th cruise will be out of Baltimore. Dover Downs has several giveaways left there. And I will say a couple things about the cruise. We did send out a special email blast this week because we are completely sold out of rooms for the August cruise of our initial allotment. We're buying them back from the cruise line as people call. But the cruise ship overall is filling up. So if you want to go on that, definitely call sooner rather than later. And then the Baltimore cruise overall from Royal Caribbean is selling very, very well. That means that if we return any of our cabins here by the end of next month, that we may not be able to buy them back.
Yeah.
So these are two cruises, particularly, that you don't want to wait to the last minute to book. So if you're interested in either one of them, go to antiupmagazine.com/cruise. You'll get all the details, including my phone number. You can give me a ring, and I will take care of you. And hopefully very soon, we will be announcing the 2013 schedule as well, too.
All right. Well, let's see what happened this past week on the NEUP News Desk.
Tennis star Rafael Nadal.
Very good.
Well, thank you. I went to, you know, you can actually go on the web, and this is going to ruin the podcast for a lot of people. You can actually go on the web now and type in pronounce and a name. And not only will it do a pronunciation guide for you, there'll be actually somebody that actually says it on a video clip for you.
Wow.
And, of course, the person that taught me how to say Rafael Nadal was Spanish. So that's kind of the Spanish version of it. But, hey.
You got a lot of passion in your pronunciation there, too. It's pretty good.
We're very passionate people in Spain.
That's
absolutely
very good. Very good.
It rubs off on me. Oh, all right. So, tennis for Rafael Nadal. He's the latest professional athlete to sign a promotional contract with PokerStars. I miss you so much. Nadal will be active in online tournaments and charity events in the fall when his tennis commitments slow down.
Yeah, another, I mean, like Boris Becker was one too, right? He's a tennis pro that signed with Stars. And, you know, it's why not? You know what I mean? One of the greatest poker tennis players in the world wearing your patch and playing your game. Why not? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Why not? All right, Duke University researchers used a basic game of poker to pinpoint the part of our brain that drives human decision-making in social situations. The study, reported in the journal Science, said the brain's temporal parietal junction reacted more when a player played a human opponent, and that activity in the part of the brain helped decide whether the subject would bluff.
I got to correct you here. It's temporal parietal junction.
You thought that was going to trip me up, didn't you?
I knew you probably stayed up late last night practicing. I was just trying to give you the Spanish pronunciation. But you know what? Here's the thing about this. the study, I don't really know what it means.
I don't either. I was going to ask you.
A couple of times, and, really, I guess the takeaway is that there is a part of the brain that perks up when we're playing humans rather than video games, because we know we're playing humans, and we suspect that humans are always trying to screw us. And trying to bluff us, and we have an extra radar that goes up to be sure that we don't get bluffed. I think that's what the takeout was from this. But I'm sure you'll put a link to the story here, which has a link to the study, and maybe some of our smarter listeners out there can chime in and help me out a little bit on it. Because I'm sure, you know, if they didn't have an opinion on what would happen if Sammy Farhaw won the World Series, or they didn't have a Phil Hellmuth impression, they certainly are going to be able to explain the temporal parietal junction to me, right?
Well, here's the deal. It's not like it's going to help us one way or the other when we're playing poker anyway. It's not like you're going to have a running CAT scan on the side of someone's head while you're playing against them to think that they're bluffing you or you're bluffing them or whatever. So really all this does is just nothing really for us.
See, as usual, my partner is so very short-sighted. And here's where it's going to come into play, because one of us is going to get in a car accident someday, and they're going to build us into the $6 million man. And they're going to use this research to turn us into the greatest poker player in the world.
No one's going to spend $6 million to save your ass, buddy. So just so you know.
I don't know.
You're not Steve Austin, man. You're just a magazine publisher.
All right, finally, two poker stars have been in the news for non-poker happenings. First, two chimpanzees cared for by Lee Watkinson escaped, and one was shot and killed by a police animal to attack a human. And Phil Ivey's divorce case may affect the campaigns of judges in the state of Nevada. That states the Supreme Court heard arguments over whether it was proper for a judge who had taken a campaign contribution from the poker star should have handled the divorce case.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I'm saddened more by the Lee Watkinson thing than I am the Phil Ivey thing, obviously.
I hope so.
I do remember when I guess Watkinson made that final table, and he made a couple of them, but they did that little segment about him and the chimps, and those chimps were pretty wild then. I remember them jumping around and him taking care of them and everything, so I know how close he was to his chimps. That's got to be sad.
Yeah, I mean, the story was particularly sad because he apparently adopted these because some other people weren't taking care of them, right?
Yeah.
And they spent a lot of money building this huge habitat for them. And, you know, animals don't like to be domesticated. And they found a way out. And, you know, I had to be that officer there that had to make the choice of shooting and killing this thing and, saving another way. The other one was actually tranquilized. They actually got. But that's tough, you know?
Yeah. Brutal.
I mean, you're trying to do a good thing, and then chimpanzee gets out of the way, and now you're, I imagine, most people are kind of a negative kind of press story, even though it should be a positive one. But the other one is very interesting, too. It's not as heart-tugging as a chimpanzee, but, they're saying that this could have a pretty big effect on how judges are elected.
Yeah.
In that state, because one of the arguments is that judges aren't appointed here. They have to run for election. If they run for election, you have to let them raise money. And if you don't let them raise money, then how are they going to run for election?
That's right. It's interesting because, I mean, you look at all politics that way. You know, that's where lobbying and all that stuff just really ticks me off. You know, you're sitting there and you're like, okay, why is this guy pushing so hard for this? Well, it's because they gave him money to be elected. You know, to help his campaign, and he promised them that he would. So he's lobbying for their efforts, and same thing here. You know, Ivy gave him five. I guess it was $5,000 or something.
$5,000, yeah.
Yeah. And now this guy was the one who proceeded over his. He had no idea that was going to happen down the road, but it did, or whatever. Yeah. And
yeah, that's the flip side. You know, when Laura divorces me, I mean, I'm going to be ticked off if the judge that we have. I get the courtroom, I look up at the judge, and know that she gave $5,000 to him. That would tick me off too. So I can see it from both ways. So
yeah. Yep.
There are no winners.
Speaking of no winners, there actually is not going to be a winner yet in the O'Malley's move this week. Don't forget, this is a three-parter. So we're going to refresh part one, let you know what we think, and then you're going to hear part two in advance. We're going to advance the story, exactly, but we're not going to actually wrap up an O'Malley's move yet. So here we go. Here is part one.
and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a 1-2 no-limit hold'em cash game. There's 10 players at our table, and everyone has a pretty healthy stack, with the largest being north of 800. This table has a bunch of players who love to see lots of flops, and then get it in with anything better than top pair. We're in the small blind with 575, up about 75. The blinds post, under the gun calls, under the gun plus 1 and plus 2 call, the MP1 folds, the MP2 hijack, cutoff, and button all call, and it's finally back to us, in the small blind, with the ace of clubs, king of hearts. Now the proper move here is most definitely a raise to thin the field, right? But we're still a little gun-shy from a few episodes ago when we flopped top-top and folded to a turned straight, losing a bit of money. Couple that with several bad runs when we've been holding ace-king over the last few sessions, and we make the first mistake of the hand. We limp. The big blind checks his option. Max rake is already achieved. The pot is $13, and we see a beauty. The king of spades, king of clubs, eight of diamonds comes on the flop. We've mistakenly played ourselves into a situation where no one could ever put us on ace-king. We're in good shape here. The only question is, how are we going to play this? We could lead. We could check, planning to check raise. The possibilities are nearly endless. What do we do?
I don't think we can go wrong here with this many in the pot. Whatever we do, the only thing beating us here is pocket eights and king eight. There are no draws that are going to get there on the turn. So because of that, I'm going to check. I'm going to be fairly confident that one of our 678 opponents is going to put in a bet, and there might be some fireworks by the time he gets back to me. And if I'm wrong and it checks around through the entire poker room, then, I'm not really too worried that something on the turn is going to clip me, and then I can come alive then. But I'd rather let somebody else take the shot here and try to build a pot up.
Yeah, it's funny. When I first heard O'Malley's Move last week, I reacted to this because I had just read some hand analysis somewhere that admonished someone for betting out into a field this big in an unraised pot. And so unless I have a huge feeling that someone will call or raise me if I bet, I'm going to check and hope to raise, check raise. Or if not, I'm going to bet the turn like you said, because at that point a draw will be possible and likely. So I'm gonna bet the turn, but I'm hoping to check now and then have someone else bet. And if not, then hope the turn catches somebody up like an ace or something. And then I'm fairly certain we're ahead here, 99% of the time. So I'm going to check and hope to be able to raise, and if not, I'm going to bet the turn.
We agree, unfortunately.
All right, well, we're gonna advance the story a little further right now with part two.
Hello again. We decide to lead out at this one. There's loads of players behind us, and we want to get some money in that pot. We put $8 into the $13 pot, and to our dismay, it gets folded around to the button. But, to our delight, he makes it $30 to go. The only thing we're worried about is King 8 or 8-8. And if he's got either of those hands, we've got outs. We repop it to $100 even. Our opponent looks at us and shakes his head. "I hope you don't have what I think you have," he says. "I'm all in." Yikes! What does he think we have? Does he have eights praying we don't have King 8? Or is it something like King Queen, King Jack, or King 10? This is a tough decision. So once again, I ask, what do we do?
Well, Chris, there's one thing Antiup is known for, aside from my constant mangling of the English language. It's that we like to expose our listeners to games other than No Limit Hold'em as often. And a new game called Wild Tallahassee Poker has been approved by the state of Florida and is being dealt at the Isle Casino Pompano in South Florida, and hopefully at other places very soon. And joining us today, back on the show, to tell us all about it, is the game's creator, Antonio Pinzari. How do you spin, sir?
Oh, wonderful. How are you guys doing?
Well, we're doing good. We just can't wait to hear
all
about
right.
this.
Yeah, good. I want to commend you about Amarillo Slim's article in the last edition. You guys did a good job. He taught me poker in 1976 at 4 a.m. in the morning in Binion's. He taught me how to play no hold'em poker. So,
wow.
I felt sad when he passed. It was he was a great ambassador. But you guys did a nice job. Thanks.
Thanks.
Well, I appreciate it, Antonio. That was all me.
Yeah.
As usual.
Yeah, you wrote a story about me and Emerald Slim. That's terrific. That was rich, buddy.
I remember it like yesterday.
Yeah, I'm sure.
All right.
Nice photo. Nice photo of a young. Cassandra.
Yeah, yeah. That was my wife taking that photo, by the way. I should have given her credit.
Oh, okay.
It was all me. All right, let's get into this, Antonio. I'm excited because we'll talk about this a little later in the interview, but it's impossible to find a good limit game these days. So, when you first told me about your game, and I'm like, all right, we've got a new limit game that might get people excited here. So, obviously, you have an instructional video that our listeners can go and watch at your website, wildtallahasseepoker.com, that kind of explains the game, but why don't you go ahead and walk us through it, how this game works?
Well, actually, it's an ante game. Everyone antes a $1 and a 1-2-3 spread game. So if you're playing against nine players, you get 8-1 on your money, which is kind of different than posting blinds. Getting 8-1 is always fun. And you're going to be dealt two cards face down, just like in hold'em. It has a button which goes along and passes along after the completion of a hand to the next player. And you can check a bet in this game. There are five betting rounds, which make it kind of exciting. And low cards play much better than high cards in this game, and there's a reason for that. Because if you were to use from 2 to 10 in the deck, there are 9 different cards. For each, there are 36 low cards. Unlike playing a 1-2 limit hold'em or a 2-4 limit, you're going to muck a 7-8 to a $4 big blind in early position. 7-8 would play great in this game. So everyone gets two cards face down. First person after the button gets to bet a dollar or check. There is a 2-raise cap in each betting round, so one could go to 3. And the whole cards, first street and second street, those are the $1 betting rounds, which cap at 3. Third street is a $2 betting round, which caps at 6. And the Wild Tallahassee card, which is placed vertically on the board, caps at 9, 3, 6, 9. You must use 2 in your hand, any one of the 2 card combinations in any of the 3 streets. In other words, you cannot co-mingle. You can't use a card from first street and a card from third street. You have to use any one of the 2 card combinations. So if you were choosing to use the first street, you could certainly use those 2 in your hand, 2 on first street, the Wild Tallahassee card being the 5th card. So it's a 5-card game, betting 5 rounds of betting, and checking is allowed. And it creates action because there's no large buy-in. The aisle is spreading it at $30. You get an 8-1 on your money in a 9-handed game. And every betting round, if you're against 4 other players, you're getting 4-1 on your money. So it offers you great action. And you can play a 2-7. And the best hand, of course, is 5 aces with the wild card. Royal straight flushes. Straights win a lot in this game, fellas. So, again, it's any 2 cards. For example, if you used a 7-8 pre-flop first street, if you got any 2 of these following cards, 4, 5, 6, 9, 10, or jack, using your 7-8, and any street, any 2 of those 6 cards, you're going to have a straight. And that's what makes it wonderful and action-filled, and you don't have to muck, a queen 4. You don't have to muck a 9-3. You can play those cards, and if you hit any of those cards on the street, you can end up with 4 of kind. You get it very easily. So I did it to create action. I did it to bring new players into the game. who can't afford large buy-ins and aren't really versed in Texas Hold'em, and are afraid to go into brick and mortar. This is for a couple to come down for a poker night out. It's for a young fella who has $50 in his pocket and wants to try to learn to play poker. And eventually, after they're not as intimidated in the brick and mortar arena, they will gravitate to other games. All card room managers agree that you need to attract new players, and this is a game that will do that, hopefully.
All right, so, when I watched the video, and you just explained it to me, and I'm a little dense here. So when there's a first flop of two cards, correct?
That's correct.
All right, in a betting round, and then there's a second flop of two cards, correct?
That's correct.
All right, and then the wild Tallahassee card?
No, there's a third street
third,
flop
third
of
street.
Two cards.
Okay. All right,
now you don't play. I'm sorry, you don't play the board on this. You can't use. You have to use only one of the two card combinations, either first street, second street, or third street.
Okay. So,
that
yeah.
would make up four of your five cards.
Okay, so you have to play one of the two on the first two that come out, and one of the two on the second two that come out, and
no,
then you have to play.
No, you're going to use. You're going to use one two card combination, whether it's the first street, the second street, or the third street. This is where people seem to get a little confused. You can use one card from first street. You can't use one card. You must use both if you're choosing first street as your hand.
Okay, that's where I got lost. All right, so your final hand is the two whole cards you have, one of the three sets of two cards on the board.
That is correct.
And the wild Tallahassee
card. Right, which makes up the fifth card. Now, that's a wild card. You can make it any card you want. And remember, there are four of them in the deck. So if you had, for example, the other day, one of the hands of a fella had pocket fives. And the second street flop turned out to be a 5-8, which automatically, with the wild card, gave him 4 fives.
Four fives.
But
yeah.
The last card was a five. He ended up with 5-8s. So he had two in his hand, one on Second Street, and the five hit the wild Tallahassee card. So he ended up with 5-8s.
Right. So let's not get anybody confused. There is no wild Tallahassee card in the deck. It's just the placement of the last card becomes the wild Tallahassee card. So it's kind of like follow the queen when we play around the kitchen table. The last card that you see is going to be wild throughout the deck. So he had two fives in his hand, a five in the wild card spot, and a five on the deck gave him four fives that were wild, and then he made it with the eight to make give him, because he had to use that eight, because he was using the five that was paired with it, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so he had 5-8s. Okay.
Right, and that's good that you should mention that. The card can be used in any fashion, regardless of what card it is. There are always going to be four of those in the deck. So you can have as many as four wild cards in one hand, scattered across the board in multiple streets. Everyone grew up playing wild card games, and I thought if there's really nothing that's new in poker, and why not introduce something that would be social, fun? It's amazing when you watch these games live at the Isle Casino. People are laughing, people are cheering, people that really don't know how to play, they put down their cards, they're startled to find out they won. and there's a little strategy involved in this. For example, if you had pocket fives and the first street flop had two cards that were over fives, for example, a queen eight. Anyone holding a single eight in their hand with an eight on first street and the wild card has 3-8s. So your pocket fives may not be as good a hand as you would think they were. So, there's a little bit of strategy, and the better players seem to grasp that very quickly, and, they know when to raise it, and that's the protection of the game. It's a two-cap raise. It's not like you're going to shove your whole stack in to protect your hand.
So really, what you mentioned that little bit of strategy there, but is there an overall strategy in your mind to play this game proficiently?
Yes, absolutely. Connected cards like 7-8 are great hands to play pre-flop, because any two cards, whether it's a 4, 5, 6, 9, 10, or jack, you have six ranges of cards there that could hit any one of the two card streets. And straights win about 42% of all the hands played. When you have a pair in your hand and you hit one on any of the streets, you automatically have one on the street, two in your hand, and the wild card will give you three. And if the wild card should happen to match the other card in your hand, then you're going to end up with five of a kind. One gaps, like a 7 and 9, they give you a range of 5 cards, 5, 6, 7, excuse me, 5, 6, 8, 10, and jack. And even 2 gappers, like a 7, 10, still give you 4 cards that you can hit. And that's the bottom line here. It's an action game for a small amount of money. And a lot of the players are saying, let's raise the limits. Let's make it a 2, 4, 6. Some guys have suggested a 5, 10, and 15, which I think would kind of detract from what we're trying to achieve here. We're trying to get people into the casino and not chase them away. We want young players. We want ladies' night out. We want couples to come in and get comfortable in brick and mortar. A nice evening out on a Wednesday night rather than seeing a movie. For $30, you take your wife or your girlfriend down and you play a round of poker. And even if they're not proficient, cards speak for themselves. And the dealers down at the aisle are really well trained. And, we've been having quite a bit of success with it.
You know, it's funny that you brought up the whole when you grow up learning the game with your family or whatever, you play with wild cards. And we'd had this conversation on the show maybe a month or two ago, about what constitutes, wild card games or carnival games, as some people try to refer to them, and why one's any more, quote, legitimate than the others, when we've talked about this too, that, back in the day, five card draw in California was like the only card game that they dealt there, and a lot of them dealt with the Joker in them. And so if there's a Joker in that and that's considered legitimate, then why aren't other games with Jokers considered legitimate? So this is essentially a Joker game. And it falls in that territory.
1971 in Gardena, California, at the Horseshoe Club, they played that game with 2 jokers.
Yeah.
So there you go. It isn't uncommon in the industry, especially in the brick and mortar places, to have spread wild card games before. And the aisle kind of went for this really well. I mean, we talked about it on a Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and on said morning, Thursday morning at 9 a.m., we want the game. They wanted a 90-day exclusive and a 5-year contract. So it was really encouraging to see. And they've put up banners. They've done advertising. Nick Sortle wrote a wonderful column in the Showtime portion of the Sun Sentinel about it. So, and you guys are gracious enough to have me on the show to talk about it, which I really appreciate.
Oh, absolutely, Antonio. We appreciate that you're columnist for Annie Up, and I did promise one of our other columnists, Big Dave Lemon, who I know you talked to, that I would ask this.
I like Dave. Dave writes really well. He's pretty gifted with writing.
He does a phenomenal job for us, and he had a question that I do think is probably one that some people will mention, and he wondered why people would be willing to commit so much money, and so much money is relative here because we're talking $1, $2, $3 bets here, but to a game where so much can change on the final card. So what do you have to say about that, Antonio?
Well, if you realize that so much can change on the final card in Texas Hold'em, the verbiage is usually referred to as suck out or river rat. that's the nature of gambling. This game isn't designed to make you $20,000 in 6 months. This game is designed to let people have a social event in a secure place with a chance to profit. We had a little lady, 78 years old. The very first Sunday, July 1st, we spread the game. She went over and played it. An hour and a half later, she gave me a kiss on the cheek. She said, "I bought in for $30. I cashed out $208. I've never won in this house before." And she was ear-to-ear smiles. That's what we're trying to achieve here. We're trying to get new players in that don't have the buy-ins, $50, $60, $70, $80, $200, that don't want to play no limit. This is a limit game that creates action every card. And that's the essence of this game. It isn't a game where you want to, play cutthroat poker, yell at a guy because he hit a card on the turn of the river. So it's kind of a moot question in that regard. Every turn of a card, especially if you're all in pre-flop and hold them, you're creating a 7-card poker game right to the river. That's what people seem to forget. They're creating a poker game that they have no control over when they're all in pre-flop. They have no control over a river card. I needed a nine of diamonds once at a tournament in Bellagio on the river to get an inside straight flush. One out or I hit it. It's a 2% chance. I mean, that's the nature of poker. You just can't change that regardless of the game you're playing.
No, and I understand Dave's point, too, is just that because the last card is wild, it changes the game rather than, yeah, okay, there's the seven-card game when you're all in, and the last card could complete a lot of draws and stuff, but essentially it doesn't change anyone's hand. It just improves it. This one literally can change people's hands from a pair to a straight or a four of a kind or five of a kind, whatever, like you were mentioning before.
Yes, for $3.
Yeah, and for $3. So let me ask you now, have you seen players that you've played against playing this game, and do you think that that last card could create a lot of frustration for actual poker players and they won't play it because of that?
You know, you have people that won't play it simply because it's an anti-game, and they don't want to put up $9 to see nine hands. You have players that won't play it because it is a limit game. You know, everyone's a little different when it comes to their selection of a game. You have guys that say it's very much like Omaha, except you get two cards in your hand instead of four. You know, so everyone has a little bit of a different opinion. And again, it's not designed for the player that really is a no-limit poker player who plays a 2-5 or a 5-10. They're not going to be interested in this game. I knew that going in.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to do is get more people into the game. We've had nothing new since, Chris Moneymaker changed the game. And, I thought of this game because of your May 2012 cover when you had Chris Moneymaker, the man, and it said, he's playing in his 10th WSOP. First thing I thought of was, wow, where did 10 years go?
Yeah.
And the next thing I thought of is, nothing's really changed. This game, as much as Chris has done for poker, not much has changed since then. And I also realized that many players have left the game because of money issues. I know guys that played religiously 3 and 4 and 5 days a week. They're not even around anymore because, unfortunately, the unforgiving nature of no-limit poker, kind of tapped them out. And poker rooms are not attracting new players. Large buy-in and, lack of knowledge of the game or, they're keeping players away, and established players really have gone broke playing this game because it is so unforgiving.
Do you think that when you, like something that you're saying you want to bring people in, so in other words, are you thinking that this game might ultimately convert people to, say, a hold'em player or just a limit hold'em player or something of that nature, because they'll play this game for a while and then realize, I want to make more money, and I want to take advantage of people who don't understand the game as well, and then convert to a regular poker player?
Absolutely. In fact, people that are intimidated, that don't know how to play hold'em, just watching on TV, and are afraid to go into a brick and mortar because they really have never been in one before, suddenly they have a chance to go in and play a game for $30 buy-in. And even if they make a mistake, the dealer's going to help them. And it's not intimidating. It's a game that eventually, when they learn to play this, they'll have interest in other games, and they will gravitate to other games. I mean, the first time I ever walked into a casino in Las Vegas in my life, I was so intimidated by the grandeur and the size of the place, and that a black chip was a $100 bill. I mean, that's absolutely physically intimidating, and a lot of people feel that way. People come up the escalator that have never been on the second floor of the aisle, and they don't even know the poker room is up there, and then they say, wow, I would never play poker. I don't know how to play poker. This game will allow people to learn a little bit about it, have some fun with it, and if they play it once and never come back, at least they've tried. So I'm trying to expand the game, and I know if you bring in new players, eventually they'll learn other games, and we all educate ourselves. And if they want to have a little gamble in their life for a reasonable amount of money, and their decisions kind of matter, I'm down there every day teaching it. I have a table right at the top of the escalator, and I teach people. I actually do instruction. I've probably taught in the last 10 days over 200 people, and dozens of them have gone to play the game, and they say it's a lot of fun. Some people say it's too slow for the money, it's not enough money, raise the limits. I mean, everyone has an opinion. I respect all of them, and hopefully it will continue to grow, and people will enjoy playing it. And I know already, several of the older women say, we're going to introduce it at our home game, which is good for everyone as well. Because, we all played wild card games. I don't care who you are. Growing up, you played a wild card game at one point or another. 3-6-9, Fall of the Queen, baseball, circle games. Everyone has that in their poker playing history.
Now, you mentioned, one of the other things that keeps the game exciting is bad beat jackpots. How does a bad beat jackpot work in this game?
Well, we're not doing one yet at Isle, but eventually we will have bad beats, and quite honestly, they'll get hit almost on a daily basis. They won't be large. They'll probably be in the range of $300 to $500, and we might start out with five queens or better beaten by five aces. And then if it isn't hit in two or three days, it might be a royal beaten by any five-card hand, and it'll be nice to buy in for, $30, and 20 minutes later, someone handing you $200 or $300. I mean, that's one of the advantages. Once the players start to see that the jackpots are getting hit on a daily basis, there'll be a lot more interest in this game.
Well, another advantage, too, is that the poker rooms will pretty much be guaranteed that they're going to get max rake on this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be good for the player, good for the dealers. They live on tips, and, they're going to deal. You'd be surprised how many hands they get out in a 30-minute down. They get about 20 hands of this out because a lot of people fold after the first flop. They won't even go in for the $2. But a lot of people also realize it's good to see the second street flop because you're looking at two cards in your hand, two on first street, two on second street. You're looking at six cards for a dollar ante and two $1 bets. But if it's checked around, you're looking for them for three. Occasionally, you'll see a hand that will get to third street and will have been checked all around, and that's kind of a small pot. But then suddenly, there's a $2 bet. Someone raises it to four. It may or may not be capped at six, and you're looking at two to three people to see, the wild Tallahassee card.
Yeah.
And there's a $3 bet and a call, and suddenly you've got a $26 pot that you invested $6 in.
Yeah. All right. Well, obviously, it's being played at the Isle now. I know you're working to get it some other places. Are there some places that some of our listeners might expect to see this soon?
Well, the Isle was so kind in sending it up to Tallahassee for approval. It was sent up on June the 12th. The legislative body, the paramutual industry, on the 21st approved it. So 9 days in the making. And the Isle has a 90-day exclusive on it, which began July 1st and will end on September 30th. And I've got interest from four or five other places in Florida. I've got interest in Mississippi, Louisiana, California, and Nevada. They want a new game that will bring new people in, and you don't have to be a sophisticated player. You don't have to know that you've got an 11% chance of flopping a set in this game with a pocket pair in your hand. You don't have to know these things. All you have to know is it cost me $1 to see the next street, and I'm going to do that. So it's fun. It's exciting. The wild card brings a lot of cheers and laughter into it. It really has become a social event as far as we've seen. Now, if it got up to higher limits, one guy out in California at a casino card room that will go unmentioned right now said we might play this at 10, 20, and 30 with a $10 ante and a three raise cap.
God.
He says, because we've got guys out here that want, would probably want to play this with a $2,000 buy-in, and they're looking for $2,000 and $3,000 pots, which this game has the potential to generate. So, it's just a beginning. It's just a thought. It's just an idea. It's hopefully going to, again, bring a lot of people in. And, doing podcasts like this, exposing it, will help. Eventually, hopefully, we'll get it into some of the pub poker leagues. Our good friend Frank Greentree has expressed an interest in doing that. So, we'll see where we go. But right now, 90 days until October 1st, exclusively at the Isle in Pompano Beach. If you're in the listening area or you're coming down, come in and take a look at it. We got a wonderful table, too, that they designed a nice felt. We've got other felts in the working. We also have a casino game, a table game that plays on a blackjack table that will allow you to play against the dealer, which I think will replace Let It Ride and games like that, that really go in there and there's four tables and none of them are even open. So it will be good for casinos that don't feature card rooms.
So why did you name it Wild Tallahassee Poker? Was that so you'd hope it get pushed through regulation quicker?
Well, actually, I've lived in Florida 33 years. Florida is my home, and Tallahassee's our state capital. And I wanted to feature two things. Number one, it's a wild card game. And number two, what better name than Tallahassee? And we use the Florida Panther as our symbol. It's really a cougar, and they're spread all over, but we call it a Florida Panther here. So, we're going to make sure that, we've got the appropriate credit. And I didn't think the people up there could reject it when they heard that name, quite honestly. Yeah, that was a little bit of a political play since we're in an election year. I figured I'd be a politician as well.
Now, lots of people sit around, mostly when they're drunk, trading new poker games. Tell us about the process of this, how hard it was to come up with something, how much you experimented with folks before you tweaked it to the point where you thought it was good to take to somebody like the Division of Paramutual Wagering.
I'm going to be totally honest with you. That May 2012 cover with Chris Moneymaker, it said the man on it, the 10 years, I kind of said this earlier. So after that, I thought, what would really change it? What would bring more people in? And I went over to my pool table, and I shuffled a deck of cards, and I started putting them down. And about 7 minutes later, I had the game quite on. And that's absolute truth. And then I showed it to some people, and they played it, and they said they liked it. So about three hands into that, I realized that this could be something that could be good for the game, good for the house, good for the player. And could bring the social aspect back. Years ago, we always had a social event, regardless of what stakes. We're playing 15, 30 limit poker for a living, and we're playing against the likes of Amarillo Slim and really top-notch players in Vegas in the early 70s. Linda Johnson was always among those groups. Tom McAvoy, T.J. Cloutier, they all played limit poker. We didn't have this no-limit experience unless we played the tournaments at the Las Vegas Club, $55 tournaments. So it was social. You got beat a hand, you didn't get upset. Now, if you go into a lot of card rooms, there's a viciousness at some tables. There's an actual, I would kill you if I could right now because they hit a card and, the fellas beat for a lot of money. That's not a pleasant feeling. Even if you're not involved in the hand and you're sitting at the table, some people are really intimidated by that. And I've seen guys get up off the table and say, I'm not playing at this table. And they go to another table because there's just too much animosity. It carries over hand to hand to hand. And quite honestly, it's uncomfortable for a lot of people. Some people express that. Other people just, you can literally see it on their face. So it's about time that we brought the social aspect back into the game and have a little fun with it. And again, it's not for a sophisticated player. It's not for a player that is playing 2-5 no limit or 5-10 no limit. I was buying into a tournament that has a $5,000 entry fee. I mean, it's not created for those. But those same players could bring their wife down to the poker room and sit her on the table for a $30 buy-in while they're playing their 2-5 and get her out of the house and off the couch, and maybe it will save a few marriages. the wife can go with them. There's a lot of factors in this, and again, it started with your May 2012 cover.
We'll expect any royalty checks to be made.
I've already sent you the same royalty checks that I sent you when you were on the show every Monday night. In fact, they've been mailed. I noticed you haven't cashed any.
Yeah, no, we did it out of respect to you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
To the wall.
Yeah.
One of the things about creating a game, too, generally when you create a game for a casino, a lot of times you have to worry about what the edge is for the casino and make sure that it's something that they're going to make a lot of money at or whatever. But in this case, really, you just had to find a game that was just interesting that people would want to play, that would be fun, that they'd sit down at, and then that way the house would make a rake. Was that an easy selling point for you to create a game like this, so you didn't have to go through all the math and all the other stuff that would sort of disguise the game for the players to not realize they're getting beat?
Well, they realized that in Florida, most houses rake $1 at either $6 or $10. So when you have nine players on a table, each anteing a dollar, if it's a $10, $1 rake at 10, they're $1 away from raking a dollar. Unlike the 1-2 no limit, where there's a small blind for a dollar, a big blind for two, someone limps for two, you've got $5 in, and everyone goes out, and now suddenly the small blind folds, the flop comes, the big blind checks, the other guy bets $2, and the hand is over. And that house that's raking a dollar on 10 didn't make a dime.
Yeah.
Here they can have potential of getting a dollar at least every single hand, and when the pots hit between $36 and $45, they're going to rake the maximum amount, which of course is $5. Everyone knows that. Everyone understands it. I mean, every other game they're raking the max every time it hits you know, those figures. Everyone has a different standard, but they're all going to get five after at least $36 or $45. So some of these pots are only $20, but the house is making you know, a couple of bucks, whereas before you know, they're not really making any money when the people that want to play aces, kings, and queens in their limit game aren't entering the pot with a 7-6. Here, a 7-6 is a great hand.
All right, Antonio, we appreciate you coming on the show. Wish you the best of luck with Wild Tallahassee Poker. And before we let you go, remind folks where they can go to get more information and see that fabulous video of how to play the game.
WildTallahassePoker.com. And my wife, Celine, who is a professional dealer, is also on there dealing for us, and I'm kind of narrating it. It's a real simple game, real easy to understand. Even if you don't know how to play poker, you can come and try the game, because the dealers are going to tell you how you did at the end of the hand, and of course you're going to allow cards to speak for themselves, so there aren't going to be any real people that can't play this game. If you've got a little gamble in you and you want to have a night out, WildTallahassePoker.com. Take a look at the video. And hey, fellas, thank you very, very much for allowing me to be on. And I want to tip my hat to you guys for the Amarillo Slim article in last month's edition. And I look forward to you know, expanding this across the nation and hopefully attracting a lot of new people. And only time will tell, really.
All right, Antonio, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, fellas. Good luck.
This is Joe Navarro, and you're listening to the best poker cast in all the universe, Ante Up, the absolute best on poker.
Okay, we're back in the situation game this week, Chris.
Situation.
See, I'll let you do that.
Thank you, buddy.
It's probably getting a little old and tired out there for our audience, but now you're freshening it up.
Hey, Snooki is still in the news. We can still do situation.
All right, comes from a longtime listener, Mike from London. And he said, today I'm not in London, but on a plane leaving Las Vegas, where I met some friends and played in a few tournaments. He says, I have a hand from a tournament I played at the Aria Casino, a very gorgeous place.
Yeah, more.
You know, one of our listeners, TBDBIBDBL on the forum, some kind of combination of that.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was playing in that casino when we were hanging out there and saw us and accused us of sleeping. But, you know, if I had to sleep in a poker room, I'm going to pick the Aria. It's very nice.
I tell you, we were in Ivy's room, man. I could definitely get some Z's in there.
Absolutely.
That was a nice place.
All right, but back to Mike from London. So they were playing this tournament at the Aria. Tournament had around 60 players, and it paid the top five spots. We were down to 11 players, and I was at a six-player table. So the air table obviously had five. Look at my amazing mathematical
remarkable
skills.
Math skills. Remarkable.
Absolutely. I'm not a field player anymore, Chris. I'm a math player.
You're a tangible math player.
All right, Mike has 54,000 in chips, which was above average. The blinds were 800, 1,600 with 200 antes. Mike was on the button. It folded the cutoff who limps. He, our hero, Mike, has ace of clubs, king of spades. Finish the situation for us.
Well, I like my spot. I have position. I have a very premium, well, not very premium, but I have a premium hand. And I only have one limper, and he's the guy in the cutoff. So, or person in the cutoff. I don't know if it's a woman. So I'm going to raise here. Normally, I would make it about 4,800 or so. But we had a limper, so maybe I'll make it $5,000 or $6,000. Does that sound about right?
$6,000 sounds right. You got some andies in there, too.
Yeah, so $6,000.
You know, at this point, when you get, I mean, that's 2,400 plus, what, 3,600 in dead money, not counting the limp, which is, so...
5,200
of dead money in that pot.
Yeah.
You know, if you can win that, you increase your chip stack by 10%.
Right.
Even if it doesn't go to the flop. So I'm happy putting in a decent raise here. Love to just pick up that dead money. And if not, I got position and great hand, right?
Yep.
All right. Well, our hero raised to 5,000. Close enough.
Yeah, it's close enough,
A little bit more, but close enough. Big blind and the cutoff calls.
Ooh.
All right. So not enough.
Well, the big blind. Oh my God, that's what does a big blind have? Huh. Okay, cutoff could easily have like a suited connect, you know, like a suited eight, baby ace, or small pair or something, and that's why it was just a call and then a call again, hoping to hit a set. But the big blind, what is that hand? That's interesting.
Yeah, and he says the person that cut off was a solid player with about 70K. Okay. So, you know, it's less than 10% of his stack to call there. So, I mean, it could be a wide range of hands. You know.
Okay.
Says the big blind was a young Asian woman who was very aggressive and would play most ace-x combinations in any two Broadway cards. And she started the hand with 60,000.
Well, I don't know why her nationality matters. I mean,
give me the details.
No, I'm not you, Em. I don't know why he cares that she's Asian, but whatever.
Some people, you know, like to play the stereotypes. So.
All right. So we're looking at somebody who likes to play any ace or Broadway, and she has 60.
I like her being in the pot. I'm going to say that right now.
Yeah, and especially with the hand I have. That's a great person to have in the pot with you. And then the cutoff was solid and had more than us. So they both have us out chipped. But we're more than average. Okay. All right, I'm ready to go.
Much more worried about the cutoff in this hand.
Yeah, I am a little worried about the cutoff. Although, like I said, I think it's easier to put the cutoff on a hand, though. Right?
Yeah. All right, so pot 17,000. Flop is 9 of clubs, 5 of clubs, tray of clubs. So 3 clubs, and we'll remind everyone that we have the ace of clubs in our hand. After 5 seconds, that's a Swiss precision stopwatch.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah. Did he have a stopwatch next to him?
I'm sure he did. People don't make up this stuff. After 5 seconds, the big blind goes all in. And she started hand again with, what do we say, 60K. So she called 5, so 55. So she put 55 in there.
Okay.
So essentially, we're all in if we call here.
Right.
Cutoff thought for 2 minutes and finally folded. And we're left to make a decision for our tournament life.
Well, you're so close to the money. You do have the nut flush draw. I just hate calling off all my chips on a draw when if I fold, I still have 49,000 chips, which is plenty to play in this tournament still. You know, 10 big blinds is... it's only 16,000, so I you're so close to the money. This person went all in, has taken the decision off of her plate. You can't do anything to come back at her. All you have is one decision, call or fold. So I don't know. I know it's the nut flush draw, but I don't want to be out either. You know, I realize if I double up here or double through or double
or both
or double,
what can it be both?
double bubble. I don't know, but whatever the double is, you know, it definitely would put us in a good position to win this thing, which is what we're trying to do. God, I don't know. I know the ace and the king would be good probably for someone to shove here. They wouldn't have a. I don't think they'd have a set. They could. They could have a set. They could have a.
You never know.
Yeah, but they could have a smaller draw than us too. They could have king queen with a king of clubs. You know, who knows what she's doing. God. All right, I think we're behind, but statistically we're probably 54-46 or something like that. I think it might be something like that. It might be a small pair. It might be ace nine because she said she plays any ace. And she wants to protect her hand. I mean, who knows? But I'm gonna fold.
You're gonna fold, really?
Yeah, I'm gonna fold.
Wow.
Because it's a draw. I realize two overs.
I'm not criticizing you. Okay. I'm just surprised because I'm gonna call it here.
You're gonna call?
Well, you know, I think, and here's the thing: I really want to know what the payouts are for these top five spots. You know, usually we're close to the money. I don't really get too excited about being close to money when we're 11 players and we got six more to go. So I don't necessarily think we're that close right now. So at this point, I'm still playing to win. Not that I ever not play to win, but, you know, when you get closer to the bubble, then we got to start considering the fact that, you know, can I make a little bit of money here?
Yeah.
That changes my decisions a little bit. I mean, at this point, I mean, we were above average before the hand started with 54,000. We win this pot, and we are, you know, we double the dead money. We've got a pretty good commanding chip stack at that point. If I think I'm going to need those chips to win this tournament, I hate calling off like you do, but what we've been described, this lady's been described as, I think we have outs, a decent amount of outs here. I don't know whether our ace is good, because he says they play ace X combination, so it's very likely that she could have a ace 9, ace 5, the ace isn't going to help us. But either the ace or the king should help us, I think. Unless she has the set. And then, of course, we got the clubs, which will always win unless the board pairs and she has the set. You know, I think we're far enough out now that I'm willing to gamble a little bit here. Again, depending on what the payouts are. I mean, if it's top heavy in first place or second place, make a lot in 3, 4, 5, you know, double their money. I'm going to take this opportunity to really chip up here, and if I go home, I go home. It's a little flatter, then maybe that changes a little bit. But right now, I think I'm going to gamble here, even though I generally don't like to call off my chips.
Let's say that it is a coin flip. Let's say that she does have something like ace 8-8 or something, or, you know, whatever, and with the 8 of clubs. And it's, well, the percentages make it 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
So that would mean if it's 50-50, you have to be getting 2-1 on your money, right? For it to be a correct money decision. Yeah. We're not getting 2-1 on our money here, right? Are we? We're getting like 1 in.
Well, we'll more third. Than double up in this hand.
But it's not 2-1 on your money to call, though, right?
Well, that's true, yeah.
It's like 1 1/3 or something. I haven't done the math yet because I haven't really figured it out. But it seems like mathematically it's poor decision but to call. But it, like you said, every once in a while you got to take a chance. But the only thing is I don't like having to need outs for my tournament life.
True.
When I have the choice to fold. It's different if you go all in with queens and a guy calls you with kings and now you're you know pre-flop, then you're looking for outs to win because you thought you were getting in good. Here you have the option of getting out of this and
still having a decent
doing it mathematically a correct decision. So
yep.
I mean even it is 50-50, if it doesn't come on the turn, then you're a significant underdog. I think you're still a little bit of an underdog here, even if your ace and king are good. If that doesn't come on a turn, you're a significant dog after that, and you're just blowing the math out there. So I agree with you. I mean, in the old days, I think I just shove because I want to win the damn thing and hope it gets there. And if it doesn't, hey, I walk out. But lately, I don't play a lot of tournaments anymore, hardly at all. And when I do play tournaments, I usually get crippled or knocked out on a hand where I feel like I've got a massive holding and a ton of outs, and they just don't get there. And I'm just tired of not getting there. and doing it against the math on top of it, I think I might just fold here. So I'm going to stick with my fold.
Well, I'm interested what our math folks say about this too, because this is the kind of that behind the scenes calculation that we're convincing Gundam that math idiots like us do. To me, I mean, initially, I'm just thinking this lady's aggressive. She plays a lot of weak holdings, and my experience with that type of player is that they know that a all club board, particularly a 9-5 tray, very likely didn't hit anyone, and people are scared of it. And when you put that much money in, even if you think that you might be ahead, you're going to do exactly the calculations that you did, that it's not worth calling off my chips. Factor that into that weird mathematical calculation. So I think that's where math gets jumbled for me, because, you know, Gundam out there can make a calculation on what all that makes. I can't. I have a feeling that this is a good spot for me to call, regardless of, I guess, whatever the math ends up saying.
Yeah. I mean, and I know what they're thinking is, you know, because I'm thinking in my head that this is or you're thinking in your head that this is the type of player that makes these types of moves, so you're calculating that in your head. So you're using the internal math and thinking that your ace or your king or your club will be good if it comes. And essentially, we're both doing the same thing. It's just I'm coming to a different conclusion just because I'm using the hard numbers of what it will cost me and what the odds are me making my hand are, and I'm going to fold based on that.
You will never hear me complain about folding at this spot. At this point, you know, again, it's these little tiny, you know, I play a lot of these 40, 50, 60 player tournaments. That's what I do most of the time. Mm-hmm. They all pay 3, 4, 5 spots. And, you know, and then you factor in the rake involved in these. If you play them a lot like I do, you really got to hit a couple of big caches to come out ahead in the long run with these things. So there are times that I'm going to play conservatively around the money to get in there, and there's times that I'm going to swing for the fences. And to me, you know, just my gut is telling me at this point that this is one of those times where I need to swing for the fences. And, you know, I'd be pleasantly surprised if she turns over King of Clubs, Queen of Spades, or something.
All right, so let's see what happened then. What happened?
All right, so he's asking, should I call for all my chips? I was betting 49K to make 66K, so slightly better than even money. If I would win, it would be near the chip lead with over 20% of the total chips in play, and I have an excellent chance of making the money and a chance to win it. If I folded, I would still have a decent chip stack and still a reasonable chance of making the money. See? Both of our thoughts together in one paragraph.
So let me ask you before we move on. He's talking about, if he has to bet 49 to win 66, that's 1 to 1 point whatever, 2, 3, right. 3 of them, or whatever, right? So if it's a 50-50 proposition, does it need to be 1 to 1 money for you to make it worth your while, and it is worth his while to make this call? If he thinks he's 50-50? Or does it have to be 2 to 1? Because 2 to 1, that means you have to have it has to be more than 49, has to be 98 in the pot then, right? For it to be 2 to 1 on your money?
Yeah, I'm going to leave this to our binary bunch to answer. Sure, they will explain it. I simply just have a feeling that I'm ahead here. That I should call here.
Well, if it's a coin flip, if the coin flip means 50-50 and it means 1 to 1 on your money, then obviously you make the call here. But I think you need to have 2 to 1 on your money to make this call. So that's why I didn't make the call.
Okay. He says, again, I put her on either ace-x, where X is a 5 to a jack, or she may have a small. I had a chance to dominate her hand if she had a small pair or had a 9 or 5 in her hand. I still had lots of outs. Even with a set, I still had a chance for the nut flush. So what would you do in this situation? He says, I eventually called. She showed 7 of clubs, 7 of hearts.
Yeah, oh, I said 8 of clubs. I said, I wonder if she had 8 of clubs something. Yeah, that's very. That's interesting, because I was thinking the cutoff would have had that hand.
We'll tell how the rest of the hand worked out here, too. But, you know, again, I think this plays into her game, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, people don't like these all-club boards. I'm in the big blind. This looks like a hand that a big blind hit. I'm going to shove and probably scare everybody out of the pot. And if they call, you know, hey, I still got this naked club here, and I got a pair, and my hand might be good. You know, obviously it's a risky play, but she's an aggressive player, and that's how the aggressive players make their chips, right?
Yeah.
That's what made us think about folding, right? Yeah. It would have got you to fold.
Yeah. And of course,
she didn't have the best hand. So.
Now that I think about it, getting back to the odds thing again, I mean, it's got to be 1-to-1 on your money, not 2-to-1. So if I had really realized that like an idiot, I didn't realize it during the beginning of the hand, but I probably would have made the call thinking if it was a coin flip. If I definitely thought it was a coin flip, I probably would have made the call now thinking about it being 50-50. And if I'm betting 49 to win 66, then it's obviously when you do a coin flip with your friend, then you bet a dollar for a dollar. So I probably would have made the call now.
All right, so the turn was a 9 of hearts.
Nah.
River was a jack of diamonds.
Nah.
It's knocked me out as I made the walk back to the hotel room. I looked up the hand after the flop, and it still had me at a 49 to 51 underdog, or essentially a coin flip.
Yeah.
The cutoff showed 9 of diamonds. Diamonds.
Queen of diamonds?
Yep.
Yeah.
Would have won a lot with the trips. My eventual decision was to go for the win rather than limping my way to a min cash.
Yeah, it's essentially a coin flip for your money, and you're getting better than a coin flip on your money. So I guess it was the right call. It's the right call. I would just, for some reason, my math was thinking 2-to-1 on money. I don't know why I was thinking that. It's got to be 1-to-1 for a coin flip. If that's what you believe it is, you know, if you think you're 50-50 and you're getting more than 1-to-1 on your money, then you have to make the call there, I guess. You don't have to. I mean, you could fold, but mathematically, right, it's the wise decision. So, I don't know what I was thinking, 2-to-1. God. All right, so, yeah, I don't fault him then. I mean, I think that's what you got to do. 2 overs, big ace to the nut flush, and you're 5 away from the money, like you said. So, you're not guaranteed to make the money anyway if you fold. So, why not go into that with a big, big stack? So, I would have called.
And 20% of the total chips at that point, then I think, you know, this is why I love tournaments, these type of tournaments, because there's so much strategy at this point. Once you get 20% of the chips in this kind of tournament, you really have a lot of weapons at that point. I'm not talking about just about the chips. I'm talking about, you know, you can open a lot of pots and really scare people out and keep picking up the blinds and change that 20% to 30%, 40%, 50% as you go.
Right.
You have money to play with. You want to make some loose calls and knock some people out. You know, you got a lot of opportunity at that point. You have that many chips. I mean, when you get down to that kind of chip stack with the 10 players left, you can do a lot of different things.
Yeah. And I think my initial mathematical reasoning was not that ace and the king were good, just thinking of a flush draw getting there.
Yeah.
And that's like 30-something%, you know, so if that 30-something% you need 2-to-1 your money, that's got to be where I was derailed there. But I agree. I think that with a stack like that, and you're sitting at one table with 9 other players, you're going to do some serious damage and do some serious manipulation of the other stacks and work your way even to a bigger stack. So, yeah, it just depends on what you're, you know, if you're playing it, it's a $50 tournament and the money doesn't mean anything to you, and you're really just looking to try to make a big score with that little bit amount of money, then you got to take chances like this once in a while. And again, this wasn't even that big of a chance if you believe that your ace and king were good if they hit. So,
yeah,
you know, I would definitely probably would have made this call now.
Well, payout makes a big difference, too. I mean, obviously this had a tiered payout because it's a normal tournament. But if this was a satellite where the top 5 spots were all the same,
yeah,
I don't make that call.
No. All right.
All right, Mike, we appreciate you sending us your situation. And we're going to be happy to send you a download of the Chinese 13 from Smapsoft. You don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store.
All right, I want to thank Antonio Pinzari for being on our show today. Always interesting to learn new games. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network. We'll be right back.
But really, your impression of Apu is like the best impression that you do. It's not very good, but it clearly is the best impression you do, because everyone else sounds like your father. But that one, when you called the other day and you did that, it was like, wow, Scott's branching out. He actually does a decent impression now. It's still not very good, but it's just better than what you normally do.
I'll take that.